We are halfway through the conference finals round in the 2025 playoff, where four teams are currently squaring off for the right to not only earn a spot in the NBA Finals, but for the honor to etch their names further into the history books and hold up the preciously coveted Larry O'Brien Trophy on top of their heads on the championship podium a few weeks from now, with a ring and banner ceremony awaiting them this upcoming fall. What's going on, everyone, and welcome to the New 24, the episode that happens to bear the number of the late gray head coach Paul Silas during his playing days with the Hawks and Suns, as we have officially reached number 29 for all of those keeping tally wherever you are listening to us across the globe. And thank you for taking the time out your schedule to hear our thoughts on all the latest taking shape across the association. I'm your host, Gabriel Wilkins, and I'm joined as always beside the talented one and co-host himself and Torrance Stagger to talk about everything that has transpired over the last several days. What's up, man?
Hey, man, everything is going great. Episode 29, let's get to it.
On the previous edition of the New 24, me and Torrance took an extensive period of time to discuss all four teams that we're currently watching in the conference finals and what they must do in order to be the first of four wins within their respective series and advance onto this year's NBA Finals, in addition to sharing our official predictions on which teams we believe will come out on top in each best of seven series, as we will continue to take a deep dive and converse over the performances of the top players you're seeing right now in each matchup in the East and West. However, before we get into the following matters, let's take a moment to salute the league's top performers throughout the 2024-25 season, who were recently bestowed precious honors as part of this week's opening tip-off segment, starting with an all-star guard who we just happened to watch record 40 points, 10 assists, and 9 rebounds in Game 4 of the Western Conference Finals on Memorial Day, and that's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the Oklahoma City Thunder, as the 26-year-old beat out Denver Nuggets center Nikola Jokic and Milwaukee Bucks forward Giannis Antetokounmpo to win this year's NBA MVP award, joining Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook, is the only players in Thunder franchise history to capture it, on the way to becoming just the second Canadian ever to take home MVP honors, joining the Hall of Famer Steve Nash, as SGA also happens to be the first Kentucky alum to also win the league's highest individual honor. In addition to the 14 other players joining SGA on this year's All-NBA teams, is the newly crowned MVP is joined beside the four other players who finished among the top five in voting for the very award on the All-NBA first team this year, Nikola Jokic, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Boston Celtics forward Jason Tatum, and Cleveland Cavaliers guard Donovan Mitchell, while the All-NBA second team features Minnesota Timberwolves star guard Anthony Edwards, alongside Lakers forward LeBron James and Cavaliers forward Evan Mobley, as Warriors guard Stephen Curry and Knicks guard Jalen Brunson round out that squad. OKC's Jalen Williams, Detroit K's Cunningham, Indiana's Tyrese Halliburton, and LA's own James Harden, alongside New York's big man and Karl Anthony Towns, round out the All-NBA third team. And last but not least, the players who made it a priority to lock up on a nightly basis throughout the year and garner the spot on this year's All-Defensive teams, as Atlanta's Dyson Daniels, OKC's Lu Dort, Golden State's Draymond Green, Cleveland's Evan Mobley, and Houston's Amen Thompson were selected to this year's All-Defensive First Team, while Jalen Williams, Portland's Tumani Kamara, Minnesota's Rudy Gobert, LA Clippers' big man Ivica Zubac, and Memphis Grizzlies center Jaren Jackson Jr. earned spots on the All-Defensive Second Team. Torrance, we also managed to hear about San Antonio Spurs guard and Rookie of the Year Stephon Castle earning All-Rookie First Team honors alongside Atlanta's Zachary Richardson, Washington's Alex Sarr, alongside a pair of other first-year talents in Jalen Wells and Zach Edey out of Memphis, while Chicago Bulls forward Matas Buzelis headlines the All-Rookie Second Team beside his fellow peers in Washington's Bud Carrington, Portland's Donovan Clingan, New Orleans' Eve Misi, and Miami's Khalil Ware. I know that there's a ton of action going down on the court that we've got to talk about, but when you reflect over the past week since we last recorded, what are some of the major storylines that's managed to catch your eye from around the league?
Storylines, not too many. Been a pretty laid-back and chill week. But I have had thoughts. And one thought, fam, do you care about the game or do you care about the rating? A lot of executive talk coming from people. Sometimes I'm guilty of it. Right now, we can pretty much agree that this has been some of the best playoffs in a long time. I would say the best postseason since the bubble. And I know you all have your criticisms of the bubble, for one particular reason, honestly. But basketball has been great. No, we haven't had Steph Curry and LeBron James and Kevin Durant to rely on. Over this last round, SGA has managed to make noise. Tyrese Halliburton's hitting big shots. Jalen Brunson's hit big shots. Anthony Edwards, he's always shining. We've seen a new crop of guys rise to the occasion and bring the excitement to the game. So why is there so much talk about, oh man, Minnesota against Indiana possibly, or OKC against Indiana, or New York against OKC? They gonna have such an advantage because it's a big city. And hey man, enjoy the game. Enjoy the game, because between these four teams, I would say at any combination, you're gonna get a pretty good NBA Finals. Now, one team in particular right now seems to be the more dominant of the four. So, hey, we never know how that'll go. But in the meantime, between time, enjoy the game. And usually you will get those type of words from Gabe, but I echo his sentiments a little bit this week.
Funny you say that because I'm taking out the time to watch every minute of these games. And I'm also paying attention to some of the online discourse around the action as well. And you talk about how fans are quick to complain about the ratings. I really like to know, when did we get to the point as a collective where we shun teams for fouling in situations when one is either up by 3 points or down for that matter, as opposed to just stressing the importance that teams need to handle their business so that they don't have to be in those scenarios late in game. I get that fans want to be entertained. However, there's also an element of strategy as it pertains to this game as well. And in my opinion, to have some sort of gripe with that is kind of wild to me, because every moment that you unpack, be it in a game or even a film you watch or a song you listen to or a show, it's not going to always be something that just ups and wows you. And if you don't want to be fouled down by three, then don't get down by three. Same applies to the teams that are up, as you have the entirety of a game to try and put a team away so that it doesn't even get to that situation at all. It's rather simple. And every issue that you have with certain elements of the game doesn't always require fixing just because you don't find it to be thrilling. And that's okay. That's okay. Every moment throughout the course of a 48-minute game isn't going to always be a highlight reel.
Yeah, it's not going to always be a highlight reel, but they're good to have. They're good to have. That's why they change the rules, make the game a lot more free-flowing, more transition plays. Everything is for a reason. It's not always time to just play armchair executive. I can appreciate any discourse about the game itself, but I don't want to be online or outside in the world hearing guys come talk to me about the ratings. I just like, for what? Why are we talking about the ratings? Neither one of us work for what's the people, Nielsen? None of us, we don't work for Nielsen.
Yeah, we don't work for Nielsen, and we sure as hell not working in NBA headquarters in New York on Fifth Avenue. I don't get to talk about these ratings at all, especially when it's so many ways that you could go about growing a game of basketball that goes far beyond just the level of ratings that you see throughout not only regular season games, but in the playoffs. Okay, let's move away from all of the opening customs to get into the series, where the road team has managed to win the first three games in the best of seven series, and each game has been decided by 6 points or less. And in case you don't know which matchup that is, I'm talking about the Eastern Conference Finals between the Indiana Pacers and New York Knicks. In game one of this affair, we saw Indiana erase a 14-point deficit as a flurry of threes from Aaron Nesmith, combined with the late game heroics of Tyrese Halliburton, proved to be enough to help the Pacers escape with a 138-135 win in overtime, while Pascal Siakam will follow up Halliburton's 31-point, 10-assist performance in the series opener with a playoff career high of 39 points to help Indiana eke out another close dub in game two. Yet despite managing to drop both games on their own home floor, Knicks big man Karl Anthony Towns rose to the occasion in the fourth quarter of game three, scoring 20 of his 24 points in the final 12 minutes of regulation to help New York avoid falling 3-0 in the series. Game four of this series will have gone final by the time this episode is scheduled to drop, as the two teams get prepared for battle as we're recording this. As you can check out game five of this series, set to go down in NYC on Thursday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central on TNT. Last week, Torrance, you know we shared our predictions on this series, and both came to a mutual consensus as we spoke on the matchup that the Pacers would beat the Knicks in 6 games. There was a particular point in game three where New York was down by as many as 20 against an Indiana squad that appeared to be fully clicking on all cylinders until the middle portion of the third quarter came and things quickly changed. What do you think led to the sudden turnaround for the Knicks in game three? And do you believe that they have found a formula to potentially regain home court advantage?
Karl Anthony Towns, he just played with a motivation of, not going to let these guys beat us today. Constantly attacking the rim, getting offensive and defensive rebounds, hitting timely shots, just staying engaged and not fouling people in that third quarter. Really played just a huge part in it. I said last week, you can't let Miles Turner and Pascal Siakam outplay you. You're the most talented of the three. Now, we know that Siakam game two, ridiculous. 39 points, like, Cat looked bad, but he redeemed himself. Now, part of the reason may be the extended minutes of playing Mitchell Robinson next to him at the five, having another big in the lineup with him to, you know, bang bodies with. But overall, man, Cat get criticized for being soft, being funny, you know, other words I'm not going to use right now. But bro play like a dog, and sometimes it's just as simple as that. Just having that will to not lose.
Yeah, Cat was amazing. But I think what really ignited the comeback for the Knicks was New York picking up their pressure point defensively and giving Indiana a dose of their own medicine. You know, last week I briefly took a moment to highlight how Indiana has the ability to apply 94 feet of pressure on the Jalen Brunson with guys like Andrew Nembhard as well as Aaron Nesmith, who they can utilize to take turns defending and making life a little bit more difficult on New York's all-star guard. Well, we saw the Knicks sort of return the favor by picking up their pressure point in the fourth quarter of game three when New York was in full-out desperation mode and in need of defensive stops. And what it led to was them forcing the ball out of Halliburton's hands, and it made it tougher for the Pacers to initiate their offense and get into their actions more later than what they would have liked to. Deuce McBride, in particular, really did a great job of applying that pressure on Halliburton during the minutes Brunson was out due to foul trouble. And I know that really helped to ignite the comeback. And that's not something that we usually see from the Knicks under Tom Thibodeau, but it's something that has worked a ton for teams across the playoffs the last couple of years. As we've seen the Pacers do it countless times against New York, even dating back to last year's conference semifinal matchup between these two squads, and even Cleveland in the previous round of the conference semis. Not to mention the Wolves have also done it with guys like Nikhil Alexander-Walker and Jade McDaniels, most notably in their second round playoff matchup last year against Denver when those two were assigned specifically to Jamal Murray. I'm curious to see if the Knicks will continue to stick with that going forward in this series. But like you said, at the end of the day, they got Karl Anthony Towns the ball, man. And it's quite ironic that when you look back and assess the first 3 games of this series, how the Knicks offense has actually looked their best in the minutes Jalen Brunson has gone to sit on the bench due to some foul trouble, whether that's the early minutes of the fourth quarter of game one, including game three, as they ran everything exclusively through Cat, and he just took advantage just as he did 2 games prior, whether that was attacking Miles Turner out the post or taking a quick trigger threes that annoyed Stan Van Gundy on the call beside Kevin Harlan and Reggie Miller of TNT, yet managed to fall for him, and it paid enormous dividends for a New York squad that needed it. He even scored on a drive to the cup going to his left hand and finishing amidst some contact on the and-one that got him pumped up a little bit. Last week, I said how in order for the Knicks to win this series, that Karl-Anthony Towns was going to have to be aggressive from the jump and look to get his. Had only 4 points through the first three quarters, but in the fourth quarter, he managed to make it his moment. And that's the version of Cat that the Knicks are going to have to continue to get. Is Jalen Brunson is also going to have to make it his own personal priority to get the big man involved. Because when Cat is scoring at least 23 points or more in these playoffs, New York is usually coming out on top in these games. And this is what they're going to need from him if they want to get that home court advantage back in game four and set up a pivotal game five at MSG.
Now, what I will say as far as the Pacers, right? You mentioned New York turning up the intensity on the defensive end, putting more pressure on the ball. In order for the Pacers to get this series back under their control, they got to keep playing their game. I saw a lot of times during that comeback where guys had open looks, guys had driving lanes, but they developed a passiveness that New York had in game one when the Pacers came back. You're up so much that you tend to start looking at the clock more, trying to burn time, trying to be too cute. You got to play with the same intensity that you had to develop the lead. It's nothing wrong with beating a team by 30, 40 points. I don't know why these teams get up 20, 25 and just lose the killer instinct. That's more so what I saw as opposed to just the Knicks intensity rise. I just saw a lot of overcompensating from the Indiana Pacers.
Yeah, and another thing I saw in regards to Indiana's collapse in game three, their offense got stagnant, man. Like when Deuce McBride and Mikal Bridges double Halliburton on a possession that occurred midway through the fourth quarter, Indiana got into a half-hearted pick and roll action. But like it wasn't really like set firmly when Pascal was trying to set up screen for, I believe it was Andrew Nembhard. And once New York switched, the Rock didn't move inside of the three-point line until late in the shot clock, and it led to Siakam having to force up a tightly contested mid-range jumper that clanked off the iron. Now, for those that's listening, you're probably wondering why I even pointed that possession out. Well, because for one, it was no spacing whatsoever. The ball didn't move much at all in that single possession, and neither were the players. And if New York is going to continue to apply significant pressure onto the ball to take the Rock out of Halliburton's hands, then you got to read and react accordingly. And you do that by making sure that you read these defenses and control the pace by making decisions based on the situation. And I know it's easier said than done at the NBA level, but if they can do that and get back to moving the ball around, I think you'll continue to see what we have from them throughout the majority of these playoffs. But they definitely did get lax. Over the course of the fourth quarter, you could definitely see it. And I truly believe once Aaron Nesmith went out with his ankle injury before coming back in, like for the final 6 minutes of regulation, that's really when the offense started to crumble. And Indiana got to get something out their bench too, man. Like Benedict Mathurin was a guy that I was really expecting a lot of going into this series. He's been rather quiet through these first three games. They're going to need him.
Well, here's the thing. Those are role players at the end of the day. You talk about an offense being stagnant. Well, they brought in Pascal Siakam for that very reason, I would assume. Three-time All-Star, who the Pacers traded for 16 months ago. And since that time, they're 88-60 in 148 games he's played with them. Now, he had 39 in game two, but game three, he only had 17. On 50% shooting, but only 17 points. That's what the offense is there for. When you can't get the three, you know, off the Halliburton pick and rolls, the ball movement around the perimeter, the ideal go-to is to get Pascal the ball in that high or low post, but he was nowhere to be found. Now, that's usually what makes the difference in superstars, at least for me. When you look at the real superstars, the LeBrons, the KDs, you know, we're talking about that ridiculous level. It's the consistency that they play with game after game. You can't follow up the 39-point game with 17. You got to come 25-30. You got to maintain that momentum. That's the way I see it. Do you see a way in which Pascal Siakam can get back to that level? Do you feel like that's what's going to be the difference maker for the Pacers to finish this series? Or do you feel like it's really going to be the role players that you mentioned?
It's got to be a mixture of both. Like, I'm not asking Benedict Mathurin when I say he's got to be better and step it up to get me 20-25, but I sure as hell can't have him getting under 10 and not taking at least 8 to 10 shots. Like, I believe he only took about 5 or 6 shots in game three. you know that they're attacking you defensively because you struggle navigating through the screen. So you got to chip in some on the offensive end when I know you capable of being aggressive. But back to Siakam, he's very versatile in the way that he can attack. He can shoot the three, plays off the dribble. He can post you up. He can get it from the mid post. So based on the way in which he came out in game three, I would hope and expect for him to be a little bit more aggressive in game four because Indiana's going to need him to be. And I understand that what makes Pascal Siakam such a unique star player for the Indiana Pacers is the fact that he's not a guy that's going to get in the way and he doesn't always need the ball in order to be successful. When you see him have games like he did in game two, it does leave a lot to be desired. Like, I don't think you can follow up a 39-point outing with scoring under 20 points, especially when you've been playing some of your best basketball in these playoffs, regardless of whoever's out there. With you being a number two option in on this group, yeah, like you got to be better.
Yeah, and he had six assists in game three. You know, they definitely worked to keep the ball out of his hand. That's one thing I think a lot of teams lack. They don't have just go-to plays, it feels like sometimes. Like, to just get an easy bucket.
I know what you mean.
Sometimes it's just like, just get this guy an easy bucket, get him back on the scoreboard, get him to the free throw line. That's what's missing. Like, yeah, you get the pick and roll, but sometimes it's not leading anywhere. And that's why Tyrese Halliburton, he also has to remain aggressive throughout the game as well. Because once the defense gets the sense that you're going to just pass the ball, they can just stick to their man. You create no movement from the defense.
It's funny you bring up Tyrese Halliburton because that's a guy that has been in the news a lot with conversations surrounding whether or not he's a superstar player in the eyes of some people. We know he's currently averaging 22-10 in his conference finals matchup against the New York Knicks, shooting over 40% from the floor. But I want to ask you not whether Tyrese Halliburton is a superstar in your eyes, but most importantly, what is a superstar to you? How do you define a superstar player? Because it's a lot of people that want to have this conversation as to whether or not Tyrese Halliburton is a superstar player. Me personally, I don't feel as though he is. However, I do feel like he's an all-star player. But as we know, it's levels to it. In your own words, what do you define as a superstar in this league?
To me, Tyrese Halliburton, he is not a superstar. To me, he's not a superstar. A superstar, to me, I always go with certain metrics. Outside of the visual, you just know it when you see it, superstar, which that is a big part of it. If you want, you know, some tangible things, always look at it like when you put this guy on pretty much any team in the league, does he guarantee you 45 to 50 wins with just his presence alone? Now, that's kind of a very hard metric to define. But if you go back in history and just see certain guys that were truly considered superstars, it kind of checks out. But many of them don't have under 40, 45 win seasons. You know, you got your exceptions like the Tracy McGrady's of the world. But he was a superstar just because, like I said, visually, he was just that good. Tyrese Halliburton. And to me, you know, if you just want to nerd out, you got all stars at a certain level. You got stars, you got superstars. And somewhere in between that star and all-star range, you got franchise players. Just a guy that's just, he's the best player on his team. The team is built around him in some capacity. Like De'Aaron Fox, he's an all-star. He was a franchise player of the Sacramento Kings. I see Tyrese Halliburton no different. All-star level player, he's a franchise player of the Indiana Pacers. Now, having said all of that, the NBA will push him as if he is a superstar. No, make no mistake about it. He's Steph Curry's light-skinned replacement. You take that however you want to, but the truth is the truth. You know, he's been positioned to be that. You see him in a lot of commercials. You see him doing the whole fashion thing, wearing crazy-ass big clothes. Once you see the big clothes, understand dude trying to tap into another world. He threw the glasses on. You know, he has the safe image. Member of Team USA. Even though he didn't play, and there were guys who could have had his spot as well that would have played. But when we're putting you on a global platform, we have plans for you. We believe you're a safe option, a safe pick. You tend to get things like that to go in your favor because there's a bigger plan for you. He got the New York Knicks script. They gave it to Trae Young. I don't know who Trae Young pissed off, but they took it from him. They gave it to Tyrese. And as you can see, we get in round two of it. Am I saying things are rigged and are scripted? No, but I let my mind wander off into places sometimes. So Tyrese Halliburton. On court, my assessment, not a superstar. NBA, they're going to treat him like a superstar for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, for me, I'm not one to label Tyrese Halliburton as a superstar because I feel like in order to be labeled as a superstar player, you have to have a level of dominance over a number of years. Tyrese Halliburton is a all-star that's on the rise, who will be pushed and promoted as a superstar, like Torrence alluded to, in large part because of who he happens to play for, being the Indiana Pacers, which is a franchise that resides in a small market. And even though you can make the case, as Torrence has many a times, that there's no such thing as a small market team in today's NBA that consists of billionaire owners, that's just a fact. However, when I look at like superstar to me, a superstar is a player that can elevate the ceiling of a team. A player who, when he's not in the lineup, you feel his loss and you feel his absence at all times. As great as Tyrese Halliburton is, and as instrumental as he is in a Pacers' success, I don't look at him as a unit mover like that. When you compare him to other stars, such as even like Anthony Edwards, it's just levels to it. And I'm not even talking about like from the highlight reel or so forth. Looking at Tyrese Halliburton, he's more so like a taller version of Chris Paul. But even when Chris Paul was playing in his prime, like he did things, in my opinion, that like stood out to me more than the way in which Tyrese Halliburton does. He's an all-star. He's had some clutch moments in these playoffs where he's hit some big shots, buzzer beaters, and late game situations that will make fans look at him in a different light. To anoint him as such at this stage right now, I'm not ready to do that right now. I think he's an all-star that's on the rise, and he has talent and an impact that's undeniable, but you got to be very careful who you quick to label as a superstar in this league.
And when you mention moving units, let's just kick the executive talk to the side, right? The element of being a superstar also includes, do people to just talk about you without you being attached to anything else?
Right.
Like Tyrese Halliburton at this moment is more of in the Reggie Miller zone. Reggie Miller, great player, but when we talk about Reggie Miller, what do we talk about? We talk about him in relation to the New York Knicks, in relation to Michael Jordan. If I look at probably the bottom of, near the bottom of what makes a superstar, like at the entry level, you talk about a Russell Westbrook or James Harden. They just drew conversation just based on them. It wasn't even about, like, I don't talk about James Harden like, oh man, you remember that trade to the Nets or the trade to the Sixers or when he got traded to Houston? Like, yeah, those things are a part of his story. But on any given day, you're having a basketball conversation, James Harden may just come up during his prime year. Same with Russ, same with Steph, LeBron, KD. Kawhi eventually worked his way into that spot. Especially going towards the Clippers, getting the New Balance deal, things of that nature. Nothing wrong with not being a superstar, man. Like I always tell people, sometimes things are okay where they are. I think it's a great honor to get your jersey retired by the franchise you played for. That doesn't mean that you need to be in the Basketball Hall of Fame. But it's a great honor to get your jersey retired. Tyrese Halliburton doesn't have to be a quote unquote superstar. It may just be good enough to be a perennial all-star who was a franchise player of the Indiana Pacers.
Which can go a long way for you. I mean, look, Reggie Miller's still soaking in the love and admiration from Pacers fans. We saw it firsthand in the midst of a timeout game three when they gave him a standing ovation. So, like you say, if you're able to get your number hung up above the rafters after years of giving a franchise a lot of success and fans moments to be proud of, there's nothing wrong with that. But moving on from all of the chatter pertaining to the Eastern Conference Finals tilt between the Knicks and Pacers, to talk about the Western Conference Finals series involving the Minnesota Timberwolves and Oklahoma City Thunder, a series where the first three games were all decided by double digits as the Thunder would hold serve on their home floor in games one and two out in OKC, followed by the Wolves doing the same in game three, as they managed to annihilate Oklahoma City en route to earning a 42-point win in front of a sellout crowd at the Target Center. Yet in the first game of this best-of-seven series that managed to come down to the latter moments of regulation, it was the Thunder who would prevail, as SGA, Jalen Williams, and Chet Holmgren combined to score 95 of OKC's 128 points on the night, to put the franchise just one win away from the NBA Finals as the series shifts back to Oklahoma City for Game 5 this upcoming Wednesday evening at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 p.m. Central Time on ESPN. Torrance, this is a series that we both thought the Timberwolves would manage to win in 6 games. And let our audience know last week when sharing our predictions. Well, now, in order for Minnesota to pull it off, it's going to require them to not only go the distance, but to win 3 in a row against a top-seeded Thunder squad that has only dropped 1 game at home throughout the 2025 playoffs as it is recorded. The overall score of this series through the first 4 games is 461-460 in favor of Oklahoma City, despite 3 of the 4 games being decided by 10 points or more. I was of the mindset that we'd be seeing a tied series going back to OKC prior to us recording this. But in your opinion, how did Minnesota end up in this scenario? And do you believe that they can even find a way to force a game 6, which, if they were able to, would take place this upcoming Friday night?
Minnesota was the team that made the conference finals between the two teams. Throughout this series, one thing that stood out to me, once again, I don't know, man, I'm channeling you today, like my spirit animal. It's a lack of maturity that I noticed with the Timberwolves in relation to the Oklahoma City Thunder. When games get tight with the Thunder, especially in the last game, Game 4, anytime Minnesota was ready to take the lead, SGA would just find a way to slow the game down, get to his spot and hit a mid-range jumper. And when you look at the Timberwolves on their end, it's always chaos or a quick three. You don't see a lot of patience out there. Now, I know a part of that may be the fact that during those moments I speak of, Mike Conley isn't on the floor because it's not the best matchup for him this series. But you got to have patience. You know, I think the lack of patience leads to the turnover. At this point in the series, you got to understand that if you turn your back, they're coming to swipe at the ball. The minute you turn your back to the rim, whether you at the free throw line, the low post, wherever you, as soon as you turn your back against OKC, they're swiping at the ball. Minnesota's doing a terrible job of protecting the ball throughout this series. And a lot of those, to me, are unforced errors, honest. And last but not least, and it's not even, well, yeah, it is to isolate this guy, Julius Randle. You've been receiving such great praise throughout the postseason, but in the last few games, I've noticed him regress back to a lot of the things that got him shipped out of New York in the first place. I saw a lot of, like, selfishness in Minnesota, both games, even during the blowout game. It's almost like he plays as if, even if things are going great, I got to get in here and get my buckets too. And sometimes it don't cause for that. Sometimes the right play is to just pass the ball. Get it to the guys that are making shots. Yeah, I know you got the confidence. You feel like you that dude. You can do it. But you got to find that balance. Once again, try to go get some easy shots. The three not falling for you, I don't know. I always feel like sometimes you watch a game and guys want to have those NBA Jam moments. Like, this will make the crowd go crazy. Let me hit this three. And it's like, nah, bro, right now, y'all been doing a great job the last 3-4 possessions getting backdoor cuts. Slow the game down and do it until they stop it. You just got to trust your teammates, man. Trust your teammates.
I think you bring up a lot of great points when talking about Minnesota. Minnesota happened to have 21 turnovers in Game 4. And to me, that's where the game was won and lost. You add that on top of the fact that they gave up 19 offensive rebounds. You gave up extra possessions when you had strong defensive possessions and didn't close them. And then you gave them extra possessions when you turned the ball over. That's why Minnesota's in this situation now. Like, when you out-rebound a team, you get more second chance points than a team. In a single game, you usually supposed to win. On top of that, they happen to shoot nearly 44% from three-point land. Dante DiVincenzo and Nikhil Alexander-Walker gave you 44 points combined off the bench in Game 4. Usually, you would think when you get that, hey, that's a recipe for a win, right? But like you said, Julius Randle, a guy that we've given heaps of praise to throughout the first 2 rounds of the 2025 playoffs, had a lackluster Game 4. When you talk about how he was being too selfish, a lot of times I could point to one possession in particular where you got Terrence Shannon Jr. in the left-hand corner ready to catch and shoot an open triple, right?
Yep.
And you so used to wanting to have a ball at the top of the key and you trying to force a shot that's not there and backing down Lou Dort in the paint, but you got Caruso coming to help and you don't want to give up the ball. And by the time he gets the ball to Terrence Shannon Jr., who's been playing exceptionally well the last couple of games for Minnesota off the bench, it was too late. He couldn't even corral the pass well. It wasn't clean, like in the shooting pockets. It's just like, at some point, when do you realize that, hey, it's not my night? Let me figure out a way to make the guys beside me better. Let me be more patient and make the right reads. And when I have mine, I look to get mine. I think the reason why they're in this situation is, like you said, lack of maturity. And not only just a lack of maturity, not valuing every possession. That was something that I said was going to be key going into this series. The last couple of games of that Golden State series, you go back and you look at, they had 20-plus turnovers. You look at game three, they only had 10 turnovers. It was their best game of the playoffs. When you beat a team like Oklahoma City by 42 points, you have the potential to win a series, in my opinion. But when you don't know how to do the little things on the margins, you pay for that. And kudos to Oklahoma City for making life, you know, tough and taking advantage of the opportunities that they've been presented with, to be honest with you.
Randall and Ant, as a duo, they got to step it up. But I wasn't mad at the game Ant had in game four. I felt like he saw guys, you know, Dante stepping up, Nikhil stepping up, McDaniels. And he had no problem trying to create shots for those guys and keep feeding them because they were the high hand. Would you like to see Ant shoot the ball more, remain aggressive? Yeah. When you look at him in comparison to SGA, SGA got a few more years in the league over him. The things that you see from SGA, they will come to Ant in time. Like he said it prior to the postseason, over the offseason. His mid-range jumper is something that he would be focusing on. And he getting to see a master at work up close. But I'm not going to hold it against him. I think when you mention the offensive rebounding and the second chance point, connected to OKC's production, and you mention how close the score has been in totality, I don't see a reason why the Timberwolves don't feel like they could win games 5 and 6. Anything can happen in a game 7. Like you said, hold on to the ball, value each possession, and trust your teammates. It's not that big of a difference in talent between the two teams.
No, it's not. And it doesn't feel like a series, in my opinion, that should be 3-1 in favor of Oklahoma City. And that's not me disrespecting Oklahoma City by any stretch. I give credit to Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren, who have showed up and who have stepped up mightily in this series. And Torrence has been on those guys long and hard throughout the playoffs, and they had their finest hour. They had their finest hour in game four. They really did. And Jalen Williams took advantage of when they was leaving them open, knocking down shots. Chet Holmgren was getting some key offensive rebounds alongside of Hartenstein and hit some shots late in the game that proved to be the defining facets of them coming out on top in game four. Like you said, I don't think that Minnesota should look at this as a series that's over by any stretch. And if you take care of the basketball, you're going to be in a game. Now, when people talk about Anthony Edwards' performance in game four, would I have liked to have seen him take more than two shots in the first half? Absolutely. However, I understand what he was trying to do, getting his teammates involved. And then you got to look at the coverages. Oklahoma City is throwing the kitchen sink at him defensively. They're in his grill, and what you see them doing is loading up on him a lot, and they can get away with that because he doesn't have a guard alongside of him that can really create off the dribble and make his life a lot easier. So he's just learning the process of what comes with being that top guy. And one thing people got to understand, people say, well, you know, Ant and SGA are peers, but SGA is 4 years older than Ant, and he's a much more mature version. Like, if you look at SGA 4 years ago, he had some struggles too. I could point out many of them, winning the first round that he had in the bubble against the Houston Rockets. But with that said, Ant and the Wolves, man, they just got to take care of the basketball, and you got to rebound. Like, it was a possession. Rudy Gobert was isolated on SGA. He held his own. Guys got caught up ball watching. They gave up a second chance opportunity inside the lane. And Rudy Gobert kind of looked back at the guys around like, hey, I'm out here doing my part. Y'all got to help me out.
And You look at the other side, and you mentioned two guys, Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren. SGA had a 40-point game, and these two guys still managed to chip in. J-Dub had 34 points on 13 of 24 shooting and 5 assists. I noticed, at least for me, he got a lot of his points off the chaos.
He
Second
did.
Chance points, offensive rebounds. He always managed to find himself open to take advantage of a three. And then we had Chet Holmgren, guy I've been speaking about all season. Always say, in 3 or 4 years, he probably will be the best player on OKC if he can remain healthy, put on the muscle, everything, you know, the cliche shit. But he had 21.7 rebounds, a lot of key blocks, a lot of key blocks. Now, I feel like when those two are going, Shea's going, you probably saw the best version of OKC. They looked unstoppable, but only a 2-point loss. So your own assessment, are you still standing on Minnesota winning this series? Because, I mean, it's not going to be 6 games, obviously.
Right.
But do you have them winning this series still?
I feel like if you can win game 5, you can damn sure get it to game 7. Because with the way that Minnesota has shot the ball at home and with the way that they feed off of that crowd at the Target Center, I got to give them the advantage in a game 6. Question is, can you just take care of business in game 5? And you got to take it one game at a time. It's hard for me to see as closely contested as this series has been, especially coming off the game 4 that they just had. It's hard for me to see them just saying, you know what, we ready to just call it one.
Yeah, that's hard. That's hard to see. But at the same time, I think we may look back at game 4 in Minnesota as one of the defining games in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's career. 40
For
points.
Sure.
40 points ain't nothing light. On the road, you know, wanting to take a decisive lead in the series, not letting the other team gain momentum, tied up 2-2. Feeling like, hey, now we just got to go get one in a building because no road team had won up until that point. You know, you saw the clip of him on the bench, mic'd up in game 3, pointing out the reasons he felt like they lost the game.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, man, it was people out here that didn't want that guy to have the MVP award. And I think that performance in game 4 was a defining game for him. I still, in my heart of hearts and my arrogance, want to pick Minnesota to win this series. But the way he pretty much walked them down time after time in that game 4, I don't see how he doesn't come out in game 5 and put them away, honestly.
Well, he has a precious opportunity in front of him to do it. And I think it was the best performance that we've seen from all three of them together. And SGA, Chet Holmgren, and Jalen Williams, you know, rising to the occasion, especially following the way that they had lost in game 3. You know, a lot of people, including us, have had questions as to whether or not this Thunder team is truly legitimate, truly has what it takes to get to the NBA Finals and win the gold ball. And when you have nights like they did on Memorial Day, it makes you think that this is why people believe so much in them and why they think that this can be the next great dynasty in the league, although we know that this has been the era of parity. And with so many looming implications of what all unfolds over these next couple weeks can lead to so many trades happening over the course of this offseason, as we heard Sham Sharania talking about earlier at the top of the week with Pat McAfee, how he expects this to be one of the most busiest offseasons of all time as far as blockbuster trades.
Well, I know a lot of people, because their teams and favorite players are out of the playoffs, everybody's looking forward to the offseason. We have the controversial draft lottery as well. But, hey, man, if Shai keeps going at the rate he's going, we might be looking at an all-time performance in the NBA Finals, at least from a statistical standpoint. It's only a few guys to average 28 and 30, 32 in the NBA Finals, and man, bro, when he gets to that free throw line area, it's unstoppable. You almost feel like he's never going to miss that shot. And he makes it look easy. It's you don't see a lot of movement from him. It's just a simple walk down. It's positioning, you know. And like I said, if Minnesota can find a little bit of that, like you said, you can win game 5. Why not feel like you can win 6 at home?
Yeah, most definitely. And I think about the moment when he walked down Naz Reid at the top of the key by the free throw line and hit the mid-range jump shot. Like, it's shots like that, especially when you go on runs and you cut that lead only to see those happen. Like, it deflates your defense, especially when you see that. And then you see the amount of times he's able to get to the free throw line. And I know a lot of people want to say he's a free throw merchant and stuff like that, but he attacks the rim at a constant level and a rate to where you have to understand that even if you see certain calls that you don't agree with, and we all can admit that we see those, referees are going to reward aggression at the end of the day. And he's consistently aggressive. And that's why you see him getting those high point totals the way that he does. And me and Torrance have said it time and time again. There's never been a great scorer in the history of the league that didn't get to the charity stripe at a high level over the course of their prime.
Yeah, I mean, you're unstoppable. The people are going to try to put up some resistance, some friction. Now, people talk about Shea being the free throw merchant. That's the least of my concerns. I hate the way these refs let Isaiah Hartenstein and Lou Dort. Watch Hartenstein, especially on the defensive end, well, offense, getting offensive rebounds and defensive end. Dog, he fouls somebody every time he doesn't get the rebound. Every time he doesn't get the rebound, you see extra push, hooking arms. Same with Lou Dort. Lou Dort gets away with a foul almost every possession. A lot of extra physicality from them that the refs never call. So complain about SGA all you want, but if you're really watching the game, that's not even the most egregious shit that the Thunder get away with. But great team nonetheless, because they take advantage on the offensive board and they take advantage in second chance points. And when they cause turnovers, they get out in transition and they finish.
Yep. And that's why they had the highest point differential in the history of the league during the regular season. And that's one of the main reasons why so many analysts and experts look at this team as an all-time great team that has that franchise on the verge of reaching their first NBA Finals since 2012, during the days in which Russell Westbrook, Kevin Durant, and James Harden were all members of that exclusive core that happened to go on to success as individuals and capture MVP crowns as well as championships in the case of Kevin Durant out by the Bay.
The thing with OKC, man, is just they almost did something I've been saying I wanted to see. They won the trophy for having the best record in the league. And they
almost won the NBA Cup, too.
They almost won the NBA Cup.
Well,
and
finally,
right now, according to most people, like you said, they're the favorites to win the NBA championship as well. So they almost swept the season, man.
And I want to point out something real quick, too. You know, there's been a lot of people that have wanted to shit on the NBA Cup and say that they don't care for the event and so forth. However, you have two teams who happen to finish as the runner-ups for the first two NBA Cups, potentially being on the verge of meeting one another in the NBA final.
Yep.
You can't say that the event don't have no credibility at this point, at least in the early years of it.
Yeah, and Bron and Giannis are the two guys to win it so far. So when things are new, it takes a long time for history to get built. So as history gets built, those things will get looked at more favorably. It'll be something that fans start to look forward to.
Well, that officially concludes yet another episode of the New 24. If you've enjoyed what you've heard through the first 29 episodes, including this one, please feel free to leave us a 5-star rating with additional commentary in the comment section, letting us know just what you like about it across the platforms you use to listen to your favorite shows. We can't thank you enough for all of your support. Or shoot us an email letting us know your thoughts on the show directly at tntfpod@gmail.com. Make sure to also give us a follow on the official social media platform for the New 24 across Instagram and X at TNTF_ to make sure you don't miss any announcements as it pertains to future shows and episodes, including on all of the latest currently trending around the NBA today. Don't forget to subscribe to our RSS feed as well, directly at rss.com/podcast/TNTF. Definitely continue to stay in tune with us to get everything you need as far as it pertains to the 2025 NBA playoffs. Once again, for myself, Gabriel Wilkins, and my co-host, Torrance Stagger, we appreciate you tuning in yet again. I hope you enjoy the rest of your week out there. And as always,